It is Thursday, July 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Palestinians clash with Israeli police at a holy site in Jerusalem after Israel removed the last security measures.
That's what the whole argument is about now. Who owns the place? Who has the right to decide?
We talked to one of the authors of a key study on transgenders in the U.S. military, and a collection of women's quotes inspires other women and girls. It's all ahead. Israeli police and Palestinian worshippers clashed Thursday outside a revered holy site in the Old City within Jerusalem after Israel removed the final elements of security measures it installed there earlier this month. Israeli police said Palestinians threw rocks at them. The police responded with tear gas and rubber bullets as they were stationed at the gates to the site. Muslim worshippers returned to the Haram al-Sharif complex in Jerusalem Thursday after Israel removed the security equipment from the entrances to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The structure was the site where two Israeli policemen were shot dead nearly 2 weeks ago. Thousands of Muslim worshippers had refused to enter the mosque and held prayers in the streets of the Old City in protest. Ziad al-Homouri is a Palestinian analyst.
They are trying to remove the doors and the cameras and etc. But the main message is they want to finish the occupation.
Israel Wednesday removed railings and scaffolding to be used to install security cameras, prompting celebrations by hundreds of Muslims early Thursday. Gerson Baskin is co-founder of the Israel-Palestinian Creative Regional Initiative. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the dispute was not about the security measures put in place, but who ultimately controls this holy site.
Throughout the past 50 years in which Israel has occupied the site, which is the most holy site for the Jewish people, it has reached agreements with the Muslim officials, either Jordanian or Palestinian, on how to keep the security of the site. And this time, Israel decided to take unilateral measures in response to the terrorist attack that was there. And that's what the whole argument is about now. Who owns the place? Who has the right to decide? So even though Israel put in metal detectors and cameras and has subsequently removed them, enormous police and military presence around the old city of Jerusalem and around the Al-Aqsa compound is such that the Palestinians are still refusing to enter space and return to normal life and pray there until everything goes back to what it was prior to July 14th.
Has Israel backed down, in your view?
Israel backed down because Israel climbed up the ladder or the tree that it shouldn't have had in the first place. Immediately when the terrorist attack took place, Israel should have convened a meeting behind the scenes, as it used to do, with the Muslim officials and say, we have a real security problem here. We want to protect everyone who goes to pray there. We want to protect the sanctity of the space. Let's figure out how to do it. I'm sure that they could have come to a compromise of even putting metal detectors in the place, but it would have been rough putting the metal detectors and then doing the checking and not the Israelis. There could be security solutions here, but not when both sides are flexing their muscles to assert who controls the place.
Are there any new security measures still in place, or have they all been removed?
I think they've all been removed, except for the very heavy presence now and an Israeli announcement that it would conduct individual security checks as seen fit, and that the plan for putting in sophisticated high-tech cameras has been voted on by the Israeli cabinet and money allocated to do that. That will take months to do, but the Palestinians want that decision to be removed as well.
It's all... Gerson Baskin said if protests occur Friday, it will result in more violence. He said tensions are similar to what preceded the Second Intifada, or uprising by Palestinians in 2000, that left thousands dead. The charged atmosphere ironically comes as Israel marked the 50th anniversary of its capture of Jerusalem during the Six-Day War. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, big news for Jeff Bezos. He has dethroned Microsoft founder Bill Gates to become the richest person in the world. After a surge in Amazon stock price, of course, Jeff Bezos, founder of online retailer Amazon and owner of the Washington Post newspaper. Gates had held this title of world's richest person since 2013 and on and off over the past 30 years. But now Jeff Bezos, over $90 billion, is now on the top of that list. A lot of fans of Jeff Bezos online. Of course, Amazon's very popular online retailer, so a lot of people excited about this on social media. A lot of people noting that he worked at a McDonald's as a teenager, and people saying, if you put your mind to it, have good idea and great luck, anything is possible. And one person even said, 22 years ago, Jeff Bezos was selling books out of his garage. Today, he became the richest man in the world at about $90 billion. Don't give up. So a nice inspirational message there that if you can put your mind to it, and of course, fall the chips fall into place and you have very good luck, you can become the richest person in the world like Jeff Bezos. A lot of luck, too, with Amazon and how well they've done. His wealth has grown from about $4 billion in 2007 to the more than $90 billion today. So some massive growth over the past 10 years for Jeff Bezos.
Absolutely.
And lots of talk about Hillary Clinton's new book, the highly anticipated memoir about the 2016 presidential election, finally revealed, and the title is called What Happened. People not sure how to take that. Is it a statement? Is it a question? Others saying what happened was that she didn't campaign enough in Wisconsin and Michigan, were states where she needed to win. And it spawned two hashtags. Hashtag what happened, as people talk about that title. And also hashtag better names for Hillary's book. So lots of people putting in their own suggestions. And perhaps not surprising, a lot of them are very politically charged.
All right. Well, thanks, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The White House hints President Trump could veto sanctions against Russia. The UN says as many as 50,000 civilians are trapped in Syria's Raqqa. The U.S. Senate is in a showdown over the health care law overhaul, and Iran claims it successfully launched a satellite-carrying rocket. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
An international astronomical collaboration called the Dark Energy Survey detected what it is calling the most distant superluminous supernova that has been discovered so far. It was spotted at a distance of about 10 billion light years away. This means that the incredibly explosive death of a massive star took place some 3.5 billion years after the Big Bang during an astronomical period scientists call cosmic high noon, which is when the universe was at its peak of star production. The Dark Energy Survey scientists first spotted the supernova back in November 2015 with the Blanco 4-meter telescope at the Cerro Tololo Inter-American Observatory in Chile. Scientists say a superluminous supernova, also called a hypernova, can be between 10 to 100 times brighter than a typical supernova. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about a book of quotations by prominent women. The top U.S. military officer says there's been no change yet to the military's policy on transgender personnel, despite President Donald Trump's announcement on Twitter that they will be banned from serving in any capacity. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, wrote in a note seen by news agencies that there will be no modifications to the current policy until the president's direction has been received by the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, and the secretary has issued implementation guidance. The reports say the note was sent to all service chiefs, commanders, and enlisted military leaders. In a string of Twitter comments, Trump said Wednesday that after consulting with generals and military experts, he was ordering the armed forces to stop accepting transgender recruits. When the Obama administration made the decision to allow transgender personnel to serve openly just a year ago, it in part relied on a study by the nonprofit research institution, the RAND Corporation, which looked at the impact of transgender personnel on readiness and healthcare costs in the U.S. military. International Edition's Lori London spoke to the co-author of this study, RAND senior economist Radha Iyengar.
So we looked at what the potential readiness and medical costs were for allowing transgender people to serve openly in the U.S. military. And our big takeaway is really that the numbers here are just really small. So the number of transgender personnel serving is only a fraction of a percent of the total force, either for the active component or the reserve component. That of those folks, so a couple thousand, anywhere from 1,300 to 6,600 in the active component out of 1.3 million, only a small fraction of those are going to seek transgender medical services. So that means that you're looking at less than 1% of the workforce seeking any medical treatment that might affect their readiness. And the total medical costs for that are really less than about a tenth of a percent of the total medical cost for DOD. So the numbers are small.
Do you know if the military actually took any of that information that you researched into consideration originally during the Obama administration when they made the decision?
Sure did. So Secretary Carter, who made the decision at the time, actually cited the study in his decision. And we did a lot of briefing of the studies to senior military officials to make sure that they were aware of the study and its findings.
Do you have any idea why the Trump administration would say that it is too costly after a completely different conclusion was found just a year ago?
I don't have any way to speculate on what might have motivated the president's tweet. What I can say is we took really a broad look at all of the evidence that was out there, all of the different estimates on prevalence of transgender personnel, healthcare costs, both in the private sector, from actual utilization rates and from the Veterans Administration. We did a comprehensive look at the evidence out there, and the evidence suggests that the total costs are just very small. The exact word we use in the report is negligible.
My understanding is there are an estimated 15,000 transgender military service members. A little over half are active duty, and that's a large portion of the general population. Do you have any information on that?
Yeah, so we actually looked at a number of the different prevalence estimates, as they're called. So that 15,000 number comes from looking at active duty, reserve component, and then a range of other sort of associated to the military personnel. It's probably an upper bound based on what we know. And that's really talking about individuals who identify as transgender. So our estimates, sort of narrowing that down to just the active component and select reserve, suggest somewhere between 3 and 10,000 active duty personnel based on the 2014 force size. So it would be a little bit bigger than that now because the force has grown since then. But again, remember that that 15,000, even if you took that number, that's not the set of people who are going to seek medical treatments and sort of impose costs from not being able to be deployed. So I think it's important to remember that only a small fraction of those are going to seek medical care, like mental health care or hormone replacement therapy. And only a small fraction of those are going to go on to seek gender reassignment or gender transitioning surgeries. Our estimates suggest about somewhere between 10 to 130 active duty personnel per year are likely to seek gender transition surgery treatments.
Now, is that something that the military would be obliged to pay for if they did choose to do so?
So that is sort of under debate in the existing policy discussion. I don't know if how they will end up in that decision, but our estimates suggest that the cost of covering that is relatively low just because of the small numbers of people.
What went into the study in particular as far as how many people worked on it, how much time?
So we had a team of people, I think maybe 7 or 8. They're listed on the study, and I don't have that total number in front of me. But in addition, RAND has a quality assurance process. That means we actually do have peer reviewers who review the study for its quality and data availability. And then based on that, they provide sort of, oversight and management to make sure that happens. In addition, at RAND, we make sure everything is publicly available. So all of the numbers, all of the tables, all of the analysis we've done is detailed in that report and can be replicated and used again for other people to assess, you know, make their own judgments. And that's a little bit why I'm talking about all of these different prevalence numbers and percentages, because at the end of the day, there were a wide range of different numbers that could be used to estimate the total number of transgender personnel. Even at those upper bound estimates, the total numbers, the total effects, the total costs were all really small. I should say that another part of what we did was look at the experience of other countries who allowed open service for transgender personnel, including the United Kingdom, Australia, Israel, and Canada. So countries that have similar force structures and operational requirements to the U.S. And we also found in those cases that there was no evidence of any effects on unit cohesion or operational effectiveness. So put another way, other countries with similar forces to ours also didn't see any impacts to their readiness.
That's RAND senior economist Radha Iyengar. She spoke to International Edition's Lori London. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Maya Angelou once said, "Sister, when you get, give. When you learn, teach." The late American author and poet is one of the most quoted women in the world, and her words are included in a new book of women's quotes. Pauline Wieger is the author of Beautifully Said, Quotes by Remarkable Women and Girls Designed to Make You Think. As Faiza El-Masri tells us, Wieger included the story behind each quotation in the book to inspire and empower others. Faith Lapidus narrates.
When Pauline Wieger decided to change careers from corporate marketing to nonprofit work, she started writing a book about her transition. And when she was looking for quotations to use in the book, she didn't find enough accurately sourced quotes attributed to women. So, with the help of a team of researchers, Wieger created Quotabelle, a website of women's quotes and the stories behind them. And instead of writing about changing careers, she wrote a book of quotations.
The value of quotations actually goes back hundreds of years when people would collect snippets in order to spark their interest in a concept or to innovate an idea. So quotations actually have a wonderful legacy of being a spark for writing. And in today's modern world, it is fueled even further by how they're spread through social media.
Beautifully Said includes 110 quotations from women around the world and across the centuries, commenting on all aspects of life. Two centuries ago, Mary Shelley, British author of Frankenstein, wrote, "Invention, it must be humbly admitted, does not consist in creating out of void, but out of chaos." Pakistani activist for girls' education, Malala Yousafzai, the youngest Nobel Prize laureate, said, "One child, one teacher, one book, and one pen can change the world." Wieger includes a quote from chef and cookbook author Grace Young, "Preserve your culinary legacy. Someday those recipes could be the one link we have to reach our loved ones."
We found that quotation through a blog post that she wrote about 2 years ago, right before Chinese New Year. And the story was that her mother would always, for years, prepare this traditional Chinese meal. And yet now her mother was dealing with dementia and so could not remember how to prepare the meal or anything really, frankly, about the Chinese New Year. And what Grace found was that when she prepared this meal, it created connections with her mother.
Uyghur says many of the most powerful quotations reflect women's thoughts when facing challenges, such as dancer Adrienne Haslett. She lost part of her leg in the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing, but a year later was dancing again on a bionic leg. Her quote is from a TV interview after the attack.
One of the producers or someone said, the victim's in this, and I said, I'm not a victim. Being a victim means that I belong to someone. And then I said, you know, I'm not a victim defined by what happened in my life. I'm a survivor defined by how I live my life. I said, I refuse to be called a victim. And they said, wait, say that again. And I said, oh, what did I say? Because I was so in the moment. When I wrote it down that time, it became a mantra in my life. You know, you don't have to be defined by this terrible tragedy that happened in your life. You can choose to rewrite your story as it moves forward.
Moving forward is also the focus of mountain climber Alison Levine's quote, sometimes you have to go backwards in order to eventually get to where you want to be.
The story behind the quotation is that, you know, I was the team captain for the first American women's Mount Everest expedition. And people mistakenly think that when you climb Everest, you just climb straight up the mountain from base camp to camp one to camp two to camp three, you know, camp four, and then the summit. But that's not how it works. You actually keep coming back down because you have to let your body get used to the altitude very slowly. It's this process called acclimatization. So you have to actually climb back down the mountain in order to eventually get to the summit.
Author Pauline Uyghur says she hopes Beautifully Said will inspire women and girls to create their own quotable quotes. For writer Faisal Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States applauds the Council on the European Union's recent decision to sanction 16 Syrian military officials and scientists for their roles in the development and use of chemical weapons on civilian populations on behalf of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The sanctions on 8 members of the Scientific Studies and Research Center, as well as 8 high-ranking officials, follow upon similar actions by the U.S. and other allies aimed at holding the Assad government accountable for violating the United Nations Chemical Weapons Convention by gassing its own people. Such attacks include one on the town of Khan Shaykhun in Idlib province last April. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has determined that sarin gas was used in the attack, which killed at least 82 civilians, including children. U.S. and other Western intelligence reports say the Assad regime was responsible. According to the United Nations, there were also 3 incidents in 2016 where chlorine gas was used on civilians. The sanctions will freeze the financial assets of the 16 Syrians and restrict their ability to travel. The United States is committed to reducing civilian suffering in Syria and recently agreed with Russia and Jordan to support a ceasefire and the delivery of humanitarian assistance in the southwest region. Russia has backed the Assad regime in the conflict. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson called the agreement the first indication the U.S. and Russia can work together in Syria, and it noted hopes that the progress can be replicated with further ceasefires throughout the country. Russia, said Secretary Tillerson, has the same, I think, interest that we do in having Syria become a stable place, a unified place, but ultimately a place where we can facilitate a political discussion about the future, including the future leadership of Syria. He made clear, however, that the Assad regime has lost credibility with the international community. We think it will be difficult, he said, for them to attract both the humanitarian aid as well as the reconstruction assistance that's going to be required because there just will be such a low level of confidence in the Assad government. How Assad leaves is yet to be determined, said Secretary Tillerson. But our view is that somewhere in that political process, there will be a transition away from the Assad family.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.